mama pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout and he started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law. Oh, what did mama saw? It was against the law. The mama looked down and spit on the ground every time my name gets mentioned. The papa said, oh, if I get that boy, I'm gonna stick him in the house of detention. Well, I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rose, the queen of Corona. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. Take me away, but the press let the story leak. Now when the radical priest come to get me released, we's all on the cover of Newsweek. And I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rose, the queen of Corona. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard.
In the words of the esteemed novelist and, I don't know, I'll give her the title, world mentor, Barbara Kingsolver, fiction creates empathy in a reader's heart for the theoretical stranger. That's not an insight new to Ms. Kingsolver, but the articulation of it is hers, and I think it's very sharp, and it also explains, at least in part, how it was that Good Kings, Bad Kings, a novel by Susan Nussbaum, was selected by Ms. Kingsolver as the Penn Bellwether Prize winner for socially engaged fiction last year from the Penn American Center. This is fiction at its best, Ms. Kingsolver says, simply and breathtakingly honest, a stunning accomplishment. Stunning accomplishments are achieved not always by stunning people, but often, and I happen to think that in this case, the person and the book, although the stories are not the same, but the spirit and the sets of voices, the honesty and the power and the humor are, I think, in both. And that's Susan Nussbaum, lifelong Chicagoan and somebody who has, whether she likes it or not, and depending on Susan, she might and she might not, she has been a hero of mine since I was a teenager. We grew up sort of parallel, not quite the same age, and she on the north side and I on the south side. But as I watched her work, and first her interest in acting, and then her interest in an ability in playwriting and acting again, and now novel writing, all of this while becoming a wheelchair user, as she has said, when she was 24. Downtown in front of the Art Institute, I think, is where things mm-hmm. changed for you.
Yeah.
Susan, welcome. Sorry I talk so much.
No. Go ahead. It's good.
Good Kings, Bad Kings, we're going to come to in and out as we talk. It's a novel about kids in an institution, disabled kids, and people who work with them, some good, some bad, some well-intentioned, some non-intentioned, maybe some ill-intentioned. And it's told in part by the kids and in part by a narrator character who has some of your voice, if she is not you, she's called Joanne. But the story also comes out of direct experience as to why you wrote a novel, and it was your first novel, and you wrote it relatively late for novel writers. So maybe we could back up a bit and you could talk a bit about how you got from A to G.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's been sort of a number of reinventions along the way.
I think you used the term somewhere that you reinvented yourself, probably more than once.
Yeah, yeah. And that's okay. I'm really glad that people have the ability to do such things sometimes. And so I did become a wheelchair user. I became disabled. And acting became less and less realistic a choice, if it ever was a realistic choice, and it never was, let's be clear. But so it was impossible after I became disabled because the theaters weren't accessible. The backstages were even worse. And in fact, you know, nobody wanted to use an actress in a wheelchair, or, you know, there were no obvious parts for people in chairs. So I got lucky a few times. I decided, though, that one thing I could do was to write something with a character in it for me. And that led to a few things. And more importantly, I think it led me to a path toward sort of answering back to those voices that I had become familiar with of disabled characters in fiction. And those were voices that haunted me when I became disabled. Well, I didn't know any disabled people myself. Mm-hmm. And so I was a blank, and the only thing I had to refer to really was things like, you know, whatever happened to Baby Jane. And, you know, I kept sort of perseverating on the scene where Baby Jane brings a lunch tray to her disabled sister Blanche and Joan Crawford, and Joan Crawford lifts the cloche and there's this giant dead rat on the tray. And with little sprigs of parsley around it and everything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know.
Because you are, Blanche, you are.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And other things, like the Laura Wingfield character in
Glass Menagerie.
Glass Menagerie. And many, many other characters in that vein. And
these characters
were
there.
Choices.
Right. These characters are... They're martyrs, but they're not even martyrs for anything, or they're martyrs for the reader or the good guy. They're not even that.
They're not even. They're devices.
No. Right.
They are a writerly way of getting at some sort of metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
They are there to help the non-disabled protagonist, I think, to evolve, become a better person, mm-hmm. or be even worse than they are, or this kind of nonsense, you know. And I think that comes in large part because, oh, it's complicated, but because disabled people have never been out there representing themselves mm-hmm. as writers.
Yeah.
Particularly as fiction writers. So it's a very new movement,
mm-hmm.
really very young, mm-hmm. the disability rights movement. I was lucky, though, because I discovered it. It sort of came on the scene in Chicago about a year after I became disabled, and I immediately went down there to our little office on LaSalle Street and got really immersed in it. Transformed everything about the experience for me.
It's interesting. I don't know the genesis, and I don't know if it's a coincidence or if there were forces or histories that helped this to happen. But you think about how many movements started, if not entirely, at least in part in Chicago, social justice movements, settlement house movements, other things. Whether this was a symptom, I mean, not a symptom, an example, whatever, but the group Access Living has been way out there from the beginning. And it just, I don't know, does it happen to be in Chicago, or were there some, was there some nexus of things that made it happen in Chicago?
Happy May Day, by the way.
And Happy May Day, which is when we're recording this.
Yeah. Well, actually, the genesis of the disability rights movement was out in Berkeley, which back in those days was just overrun with disabled people of all kinds because the weather was good.
Yeah.
And it drew a lot of people. And it's where the very first organizing started. Mm-hmm. And I think Chicago was one of the few cities that really picked it up from there away.
And a big city with terrible weather.
With terrible weather
makes a big and difference.
Terrible
everything else.
Like the rest of the country, of course.
Right.
But, you know, there was absolutely no way of getting into the streets or getting on the bus or the train or there were no disabled people out in the streets. You might see a blind person panhandling or selling some product.
Right.
But disabled people couldn't even get out there to do that in those days.
We're certainly in no nirvana, and we may be a tiny bit closer to something good, but you have to cast your mind back if you look around in the teens or whatever decade we're in. Certain things we think are there, ramps, curbs, or they're not all there, but I mean there was nothing.
Really,
okay.
From what's really the, you know, the core of disability oppression,
right,
which is very systemic, and it's misleading, very misleading to think that the only disabilities are people in wheelchairs.
Right. Right.
I guess it's the most visible kind of difference that people can sort of zero in on, but there are so many different ways that people can be disabled.
Quote unquote intellectual disability.
Sure.
Psychiatric
disabilities, you know, also many disabilities,
right.
Sensory disabilities of all kinds. And hidden disabilities, or not hidden, but certainly non-apparent.
Non-apparent.
I just saw a statistic a couple months ago about how over 50% of people in prison, in real prison, not just institutions, but but prison institutions, are disabled people, have various disabilities, mostly psychiatric or intellectual disabilities.
Well, they'll all just face botched executions at some point.
Oh, let's not even joke.
It's so awful, but it's also, I mean, remember Bill Clinton when he was governor of Arkansas, signed the execution paper. I mean, when he was a candidate even, I think, for president, signed the execution papers for a man who was so intellectually disabled, mentally retarded, whatever the phrase is, that when he was asked about his Last Supper, he said he would have it afterwards. And he went ahead and had this man executed. This was a, quote, liberal Democrat. And now what we've just seen in Oklahoma, I saw a headline in The Guardian newspaper, but on the web, just saying all executions are like this. All, and one of your points throughout the book is the concept of institutionalization is extremely problematic, maybe a central problem.
Well,
not just that there are bad institutions and good institutions.
Right. The nature of the institution is to punish, and it's there is no way that an institution can do anything but fail the people that it purportedly is there to serve. Mm-hmm. Because in reality, I think the people that these places serve are the owners. So many prisons are becoming privatized. Certainly in the world of institutionalization for people with various disabilities, it's been a cash cow for many, many, many decades.
Starting with nursing homes as well. Mm-hmm, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. And that's very problematic because the whole thing is to keep the bottom line low.
Mm-hmm.
But that's I don't want to – the only thing I don't want to do is mislead people into thinking that I wrote a screed about anti-institutionalization.
It's not a screed at all. I mean, one, it's too funny, and two, it's very human.
It's
fiction. Just to try to weave those together, because here you are by nature an artist. I would say probably by nature an activist, because you were an activist before in other issues. And your sister's a professional activist. Your mother was an activist. Your father is an artist and an activist. So, I mean, it is something in you. And here you are working through decades to synthesize in some ways, not because you necessarily want to, but maybe in part because you know that these are both pieces of who you are and maybe one is going to open the other somewhat? I don't know.
I do want to. I do want to. I enjoy it. But I also am – I have things to say.
Right.
So the key is to find ways of saying those things that are – that come from – real voices from people that don't necessarily speak very clearly or articulately, I should say, about what their ideas are, what they want, or any of those things. People like most of us. Mm-hmm. And I think the last, you know, you have to be on your guard against dogmatism.
Right.
I used to send drafts to my sister and just tell her to be ruthless, you know. Mm-hmm. I needed to know where it was preachy. And she was ruthless.
In your acknowledgments, in addition to your family members and you're blessed with an amazing family, extended as well as immediate biological, I was also impressed, though not surprised, that you had a list of people who had read, I think you said, at least one draft. And that ranged from people that you probably knew from early childhood to people who weren't born 30 years ago. And I just thought that's so Susan, that she would recognize that there are many different ways good people could give you insight into this book. Because otherwise it might just be you give it to your sister to be ruthless and your best friend to be encouraging and then you're ready, you know. Right. And I was just very impressed by that. And I think that if the novel didn't prove itself, that is an additional proof that of what you were getting at. Let's talk a little bit about going from playwriting, because when you talk about giving voice, obviously playwriting is related to novel writing and why that happened both for artistic reasons and personal reasons, I think.
Well, I wrote a bunch of plays. And I had some luck with them. I think a nice amount of luck. I had them produced here in the city in various theaters, and that was lovely. They would come and go, though, and that was frustrating, as
and you
plays do.
You got recognition for them. You won awards for some of them.
Well,
and at least one.
Yeah. I mean,
and
it was,
you got good reviews. But, right, they come and go, right.
Yeah. And it was fun.
Or they came
and
went.
It was really fun.
Yeah.
And and disabled people sort of heard about them, and that was good. And then I wrote a play that I thought was really great. It was the play I wrote last, and I don't know why I couldn't get it produced. Well, I have my ideas about it. But anyway, I couldn't get it produced. Now, I should say also that recently someone who interviewed me, a lovely woman from Lilith magazine, offered to hook me up with someone in D.C. who was interested in reading this play that I had referred to. And so I reread the play just to make sure it was as incredible as I thought it was, you know. And it was not, you know. It had problems. I don't think that's necessarily why it just didn't get produced, but it did come very close. And each time it just never made it. So I was so discouraged and so fed up and just angry and hurt that I stopped writing for a really long time.
Only Susan, not only, but among the world, there are a few people who can, as Susan Nussbaum is now, tell us about discouragement and depression while she is laughing and smiling,
yeah,
because it's all a part of the comedy of our lives and
yeah,
also about where you then went from there.
Well, that's why I can write a book about institutionalization where the characters are quite amusing at times, because yeah, I think most people are able to look back on things that were painful and really laugh at them with their friends or mm-hmm, with whoever's around.
Mm-hmm.
So I stopped writing and was determined never to give the theater world the benefit of my insights again. And they were so sad. But really, that's how I felt. I had this huge chip on my shoulder. I stopped going to plays even, except for my dad's stuff. And so meanwhile, there was this disability culture movement sort of forming, and I saw a lot of amazing things. And it's a very insulated movement. We're still just sort of in a kind of incubation period. And
when you say you saw a lot of amazing things, do you mean performance arts?
Yes.
Quote unquote stand up, I guess.
Yes, there was.
Name, right?
There was some hysterically funny guys,
yeah,
women out there. But it was the kind of thing that only, for the most part, disabled people would
right,
know about and go to. And but one night I was listening to some work, and I was thinking, you know, one of the things you do when you're just starting out is to get into your painful details about your biographical, you know, incidents, and that's really, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's stuff to start out doing and then grow out of
right,
as quickly as possible. And I realized I should write again. I should do something, because mm-hmm, I had been collecting in the meantime all of this information around institutionalization. It's a big issue for disabled people. It's the biggest issue for us. Has been for some years. And so I realized I couldn't write a play.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't want to. And so I would write a book. It made
sure,
no sense.
Just do that.
It made no sense, but I thought I could always self-publish.
Right.
And also I had no idea how to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
So it took a long time.
Get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove. You get a fast car. I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Just cross the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living. Man's got a problem. He lives with a bottle, that's the way it is. He says his body's too old for working. His body's too young to look like his. My mama went off and left him. She wanted more from life than he could give. I said somebody's got to take care of him. So I quit school and that's what I did. You got a fast car. Is it fast enough so we can fly away? We gotta make a decision. Leave tonight or live and die this way. So I remember when we were driving, driving in your car. Speed so fast, I felt like I was drunk. City lights day out before us, and your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling that I belonged. Someone. You got a fast car. We go cruise and entertain ourselves. Still ain't got a job. Now work in the market as a checkout girl. I know things will get better. You'll find work and I'll get promoted. We'll move out of the shelter. Buy a bigger house and live in the suburbs. I remember when we were driving, driving in your car. Speed so fast, it felt like I was drunk. City lights lay out before us, and your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling that I belonged. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone, be someone. Got a fast car. I got a job that pays all our bills. Still drinking late at the bar. See more your friends than you do your kids. I'd always hope for better. Thought maybe together you and me find it. I got no plans, I ain't going nowhere. So take your fast car and keep on driving. So I remember when we were driving, driving in your car. So fast, I felt like I was drunk. City lights lay out before us. Your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling that I belong. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone, be someone. You got a fast car. Fast enough so you can fly away. You gotta make a decision. Leave tonight or live and die this way.
We're speaking with Susan Nussbaum, and her book is Good Kings, Bad Kings. It's published, I should have said earlier, but I'll say it now and again, by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. It's the winner of the Penn Bellwether Prize for Socially Engaged Fiction, selected by Barbara Kingsolver from the Penn American Center. And every single major publication appears to have reviewed the book and reviewed it positively. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the industry guides, book list, Kirkus, etc. So we're not just talking to Susan because she's from Chicago, though that's also why we're talking with her, but because she's written a wonderful book. How did you then go about, did you sign up for the famous writer's school on the back of a matchbook? Or, I mean, what did you just work and see where it went?
Yes. That's what I did.
The best way, I think.
I mean, I did some research quite a bit, and I had collected a bunch of stuff, and I sort of tapped into what I already knew about writing and what I had experienced as an activist all these years in terms of just the vast numbers of people and different kinds of people I'd met that had become a real part of my personal community because of being a disabled person.
And among the people that you've met, young people have been extremely important. And again, it's not that recognition is the point, but you have been recognized and you got a big shout out in 2008 for being a visionary working with disabled young people. Because if we're not thinking about and working with possibilities for disabled young people, we got no future either for other disabled people or for our own society. So I imagine your work there sort of was it initially your idea that the novel would have kids as a central part? Or did that come?
Yes.
Okay.
I wanted to write about those places that house disabled youth.
Tell us a bit about that in the nonfiction and research part, because part of the point is we don't see those people. I mean, that's a big point, right? Mm-hmm. So what are some of the numbers and where are these institutions?
They're all over. Many of them have closed and over the years. There were hundreds of thousands of disabled kids in institutions in the 50s and 60s. And then in the 70s and 80s, things started to taper off because of some exposure of the really pernicious nature of these places. And, you know, it was hard to stomach what was learned.
If you take Dickensian and take off the censorship of Dickensianism and add all the sexual abuse and physical abuse, you start to get an idea maybe of what these pits were like.
Mm. Yeah. And so the numbers went down, but like I said earlier, people were funneled into all sorts of other institutional settings. These group homes, which are somewhat smaller, but not necessarily any different than an institution. They're just like mini institutions. They're run in the same regimented way. The people who live in them have no rights, none. And so it still continues. And also there's a lot of people who end up in jail or prison. And so I can't remember what we were talking about.
We were just trying to give people a sense of what these institutions were and what they are.
I mean, I think the main thing about institutions is that they do make people invisible. They're locked. Even the nursing homes are somewhat difficult to access. You just can't walk in. And the people who are there are made vulnerable if they aren't already. And then the people who work there are enforcing rules that are unlike anything one would experience if one was to consider oneself a free human being.
For example?
Well, go to bed at 7, wake up at whatever hour is convenient for the staff, eat what is served, do what are the prescribed activities. If there are these activities, then don't do anything.
Yeah.
And there really is not an atmosphere for, you can't go out most of the time. And the people that are in charge of enforcing these rules are people that have no emotional connection to you, to the other people that live there. And often the people that work most closely with the patients are damaged themselves and getting paid minimum wage, which we all know is they just once again in Congress decided that $10 an hour is far too much for a person to earn. So it's a recipe for disaster.
And in that recipe, if I can make a really bad word movement, though there are bubbling in these various pots all kinds of neat spices and flavors, and they're
that
called the
so
people. And I don't like to say too much about books, particularly fiction, because I really want people to read them. And I know that you also don't want to read from some of them because these kids speak very frankly, and the radio may not be the best place. But maybe could we you tell us about who the characters are? Would that be? Would that work?
Well, yeah, sure.
Give people
I'll try.
A sense. And what is the institution that they're in?
They're in a place that houses mostly teens with a variety of disabilities, usually multiple stuff, like someone might have a physical and an intellectual disability, or a physical and a psychiatric disability, or just a physical disability, but be a ward of the state for various reasons. All sorts of things. But often parents are unable to actually keep a child with a disability at home because there are no resources. Mm-hmm. There aren't nearly the resources that are necessary to be able to manage. It's
financial
a long
resources
story.
And time resources.
Financial resources and also just respite resources and
that's a good word.
The myriad programs that could provide all sorts of assistance in many areas, siblings and all of, you know, and various interactions and dealing with the inevitable discrimination that a kid is going to have to endure during school. And I don't mean just other kids saying mean things. I mean, you know, bullies and stuff. I mean the way that the education itself will be administered in a discriminatory way, which is a whole other several books, I guess.
Right.
So it's very difficult. So parents do search high and low for places that they can feel that their kid will be safe. And my point is, my personal point, although the book is sort of runs the gamut. People disagree on this issue. I think it's a corrupt and a bankrupt kind of solution to any of our problems. I'm a straight down the line abolitionist.
Where is the school, where is this institute, which is a big part of it, but where is the institution?
It's in
physically?
Chicago,
right.
South Side, in the, near the old Stockyards neighborhood, in that neighborhood, actually.
And how many people live there?
I think there's about 80 kids, and it's not a real
institution. No, I understand. Yeah.
I sort of made it up, but it's based on much that I already know, and a bunch of staff, and some of the characters are wards. Some have parents that are involved. Some don't, for whatever reasons. They have different disabilities. They have different ways of expressing themselves. They have different racial and ethnic backgrounds, different language backgrounds, different everything. And then there are a few staff that in their own ways are questioning what their role, are constantly interrogating themselves about what they're doing. What is this work that they're doing? You know, and how can they do it? And why does it feel as if they are continually sort of perpetuating these horrible policies. Because people, it's not always clear to people when they're in a job that they're trying to be helpful.
Yeah.
But in a certain context, it's just not possible.
Right. The kids have, well, each of the characters, they have their own chapters. They have their own voices.
Right. Right. They're all first-person characters.
Right. And they're boys and girls, male and female, black and Hispanic, and
white.
And white.
And, yeah. You know, various gender preferences.
One of the things that becomes apparent, particularly with one of the characters, but throughout the book, is that, as you were saying, there are physical disabilities and then there are other disabilities. And as you got more and more involved and have known more people, observed more people, interacted with more people, worked with more people, you've come to see how these things are and the way we treat people are connected and related. And you have a character who is smart and funny and hilarious, but he's, well, you know, somebody would say retarded, or somebody would say, you know, has minimal function or something like that.
Right.
And you don't just show us, because a good book, going back to Kingsolver and empathy, a good book also runs, wait, I knew somebody like that. You know, I grew up with a boy whose name was Andrew, and his birthday was the same as mine. And he was known as Andy, fortunately, because I didn't want to be Andy, and I'm Andrew, he's Andy, and he has Down syndrome, or had Down syndrome, but his parents, for whatever reason, had prematurely mainstreamed. I don't mean prematurely, but I meant they were early. I meant like
right,
premature anti-fascists,
much.
Right?
Right.
And so we went to the same day camps, and we went to Ray School, and went to Kenwood High School, and you know, there were things about him that obviously were different, but there were also just things about him that were just absolutely brilliant and hilarious. And eventually he went to Lamb's Farm, in part because where do you go at a certain point? I don't know if he's living, and I don't know what he's up to, and I'm thinking about finding out. But my point is more that we can all say, well, yeah, right, that lady who worked at the newsstand or whatever, she was cool, you know? And I think we've said, okay, we understand why people with wheelchairs shouldn't be discriminated against, but what about people with low IQs? And you and the characters kind of blow the lid off of that, I think.
Yeah, I think people are so segregated by, well, what people? most people's lives happen outside of that sort of world of disability, because for the most part, disabled people remain segregated from the rest of us, the rest of the world. And so there's just not much understanding about it. People don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always what's always frustrated and infuriated me about the way disabled characters are written, or, you know, whether it be a novel or a screenplay. And of course, it's not always the case, but 98% of the time it is the case.
Do you mind telling us a little of the background of the movie Million Dollar Baby? Because I think that will open up for people who have seen or read about that movie in ways that if we did it here, we'd give away the plot. But maybe that would give some example of what you're talking about, some additional example.
Well, there is a woman who had a very similar experience to the character in that movie. And it was written about at some length when it happened many years ago. And
she was a boxer.
She was a boxer.
And she had a brain injury?
Yes, yeah. in her very first fight. And was very significantly disabled from that time on. And Meanwhile, and there were other circumstances that were similar to the ones in the movie. Meanwhile, this movie is written and produced. By meanwhile, I mean many years later. I'm really glad this movie was made long after I became disabled myself, let's just say, because it took the whole concept of my having to actually kill myself because I'd be a burden. I didn't have to, you know, call Clint Eastwood and ask him to come over and put me out of my misery. it's ridiculous. Anyway, so the character in the movie becomes disabled, catastrophically disabled in a fight, her first fight, I think it is. I couldn't really stand to watch much of the movie. But and then she is so traumatized because it is a very traumatic experience that within the first week or two post-accident, when she's still in the hospital, she decides she really doesn't want to live like this, which is very understandable because it's very hard. In that context, okay? And she didn't know disabled people either. And she didn't know any of what real disabled people know, and particularly these days. So she convinces her sort of surrogate father and best friend, Clint Eastwood, to euthanize her, supposedly. And he does. And that's the ending to the movie. He's kind of a hero for doing it because he loved her so much that it was very difficult for him. And she's a hero for killing herself because now she doesn't have to live a life of terrible dependency and need help and all of these things that are so
awful. And she's helped to make Clint Eastwood a better person.
She's helped to make Clint a better person. And she's no longer runs the risk of being a burden to society. So it's a really bad movie in a lot of ways for disabled people. Because, I mean, I've actually had people in the past, not for a really long time, come up to me and say, "Wow, I don't know how you do it. You know, if it was me, I'd kill myself." And I think that's a normal response for some people who don't imagine that they could adjust or survive. But people do adjust, and people survive, and that's human nature, and that's who we are. And we adapt, and we don't really change what we like about ourselves. We carry on.
And two things to bracket that. One, I think research has shown that, in fact, disabled people who do kill themselves, that number is no higher and maybe even lower than, quote, non-disabled people, percentage-wise. Mm-hmm. And also, the actual character, the actual person who the movie whom the movie is based.
Katie Dallum. Let's get back to reality for a second. So the movie is based on this young woman, as I started to say, and she is now an artist living, I always forget exactly where she's living. I want to say Kansas, but
somewhere
I don't
west,
think so.
Yeah.
Somewhere around, you know, south of Chicago or west of Chicago. And I have no doubt that her life is a struggle because who's isn't really? But she is quite productive, and she's very impressive as an artist.
Yeah, yeah. And rather than telling us anything about that, it's time to say goodbye if you've become disabled. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really it's very powerful. Obviously, the characters in your book are younger people who've already dealt and not yet dealt with certain of these things, but they certainly are alive. I mean, they are lively.
Well, yeah, they know their truths.
Right, right.
They know what's real for them. And they, I think, too, it's Hollywood is a delivery system for all sorts of mythologies about all sorts of people. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's expedient to take many shortcuts where the truth is based largely on the truth as we know it from other movies. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not the cause of disability oppression or the cause of institutionalization or any of these things, but it is, I think it helps to perpetuate these systems.
Right. You travel, you, quote, network with other activists and other individuals and artists, and you are a voracious researcher. Are there countries or societies that are getting it more right, that are doing something that we might look at as a model for what we ought to be doing other than just to do better and do right?
Well, I don't know as much as you give me credit for.
Okay.
Traveling has become really hard. But
I should say then you have traveled. I know that you have.
Yeah, and I do, but not as much out of the U.S. And so I would say that there are other countries. First, it's all over the world.
Right.
There are disabled people in various ways getting organized all over the world, in the most remote places even.
Right.
But it's different all over the world.
Right.
First world countries have made more obvious advances, for sure.
But they have fewer excuses for not making them.
Yeah.
A friend of mine worked for a number of years, and I mean, it's a topic in and of itself, and he would certainly say so, but he worked for a number of years with Special Olympics. But he said the great part of it, aside from that you meet wonderful people, but these, it's every country, it's all over the world, and he would go on these site visits, and he would come back and he would say things like, Mongolian mentally disabled people are getting it together, you know, or, you know, you should see what this group of young people has done in Kenya, you know. So exactly,
yes.
It's really is happening in those ways. What's your process for writing? Do you write at a computer? Do you dictate? Do you write by hand? What is your...
I ask that
of any writer,
Yeah, I write at a computer.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do it any other way now.
Did you have to relearn typing or which hand to use or whatever?
I type with one finger. It's,
yeah, but I have 10 and I type with two fingers.
Yeah,
so, right?
Yeah.
I don't mean to put it down, but my point is back
no,
to what you were
right.
saying. We
Good.
All have our things, right?
Yeah, I'm very speedy, nevertheless.
Roger typed with one finger, and he typed a lot.
I'll never
learned to type, right?
So, I bet he had a really sore finger.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
And then do you print out and then go over your drafts? Or, I mean, what's the...
Over and over and many thousands of times.
Have you read from the book or gone to see and talk with groups of kids who've read the book?
I've read a lot from the book, but I have not read to actual kids. I've been to a lot of colleges and universities.
Right.
I would love to get into the high schools because
that's where you have to go.
I really think this book is just—it was published as an adult piece of fiction,
right?
And it is,
right.
But it would also cross over really well.
I think there's got to be an excess living guerrilla theater and reading troupe or something. Because look, say About Face, they have wonderful, their youth programs are probably bigger than their actual professional stage program at this point with gay and lesbian transgender issues. And maybe there's a way of either piggybacking on that or mirroring that, because I would think it would be also fascinating for the kids. Because, of course, there's also this question that you're rightly saying, I don't think there's been a book by a disabled writer from the point of view of disabled people as main characters at all, or they're scarce. And, of course, you're also giving voices to Latina and Black kids and other kids. And, you know, maybe there's some but he's saying, I will be the first black 14-year-old disabled to tell it from my way. And you want that to happen, I'm sure.
I'm sure there are people.
Right, yeah. And it would be
that.
Great to connect.
The question is whether people will be able to break through.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's hard.
Yeah.
But everyone who is able to is, like Barbara Kingsolver, for example,
yeah.
is now able to lend a hand and help other people break through, people that are doing work that she's committed to. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that's a perfect way to round this off. I have to ask one last mean question. What are you working on now?
I'm in the very baby step stages of another novel.
Great,
yeah.
Great. Well, we wish you all the best in breaking through with that, and somebody who breaks through many things, but I think even more importantly, and I'm guessing she would concur, she helps us to break through things, and that's what matters, is for all of us to have a better understanding of our own truths and of the truths of others, and that way it gets us a tiny bit closer to capital T truth, if there is such a thing. Good Kings, Bad Kings, a novel by Susan Nussbaum. It's out now in both hardcover and paperback from Algonquin of Chapel Hill. I've got the paperback copy in front of me. Both versions are very handsomely done. Susan Nussbaum, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
True colors are shining through. I see your true colors. Music that we heard this evening, Paul Simon and his 1972 Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard, Tracy Chapman and her 1988 Fast Car, and Cyndi Lauper with Steinberg and Kelly's True Colors from 1986. We'd like to thank Susan Nussbaum, especially for her patience in getting this program made and broadcast. Brooke Suka of Algonquin Books in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Eslin Usher, Jesse Todd, and Rose Ellen Brown for making sure that this program happened. And of course, we thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, and other friends of this program. You can listen to this and other episodes via the free Critical Thinking podcast at wfmt.com/criticalthinking. Email Andrew, Patner spelled backwards, that's rentap@aol.com. For Andrew Patner, I'm Matt DiStefano. I record and post-produce these programs, and I invite you to join us again next week for the next edition of Critical Thinking.